Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 24th of February. We're going to be talking about the jobs bill, the first hour of our program today. The Senate has just convened and they are expected to pass this jobs bill. And it is a $15 billion job creation measure. As you'll recall, five Republicans, including Senator Scott Brown, joined 57 Democrats in voting to break a filibuster of the jobs bill. The bipartisan result, a breakthrough for Democrats. Some are saying the vote is a vindication for Senator Harry Reid, who is grappling with a very tough reelection race in Nevada, and it has faced questions over whether he mishandled the jobs issue. The question is whether or not this jobs bill is deep enough, is broad enough. Senator Brown, just elected from Massachusetts, said that he wished the tax cuts were deeper and broader, but he would vote for it, and he will vote for it because it contains measures that will help put people back to work. We'll talk about this bill with Donald Sykes. Those of you who have lived in Milwaukee for any period of time are certainly familiar with him. He is the president and CEO of the Milwaukee, Wisconsin Workforce Investment Board, which is the largest workforce investment board in the state. It serves the most diverse racial and economic area in Wisconsin. Don is a nationally recognized leader with over 30 years of nonprofit, public, and intergovernmental community action, workforce, and social planning experience. He has deep roots in the Milwaukee nonprofit community. He led the Social Development Commission in this city before assuming a national role in the Clinton administration as director of the Department of Health and Human Services Office of Community Services. He'll be joining us shortly. He was going to be just a few minutes detained today, so we thought we would just talk a little bit about what we're going to talk about before we talk with him. He has a lot to say about what it is that will help people get back to work. And he says that some of this, a lot of it actually, has to do with health care. He was asked about a year ago, if somebody asked me the most important thing we could do for people seeking a job, low-income people facing huge barriers, my number one priority would be health care, not health insurance, health care. With health care, people can manage on some of these low-paying jobs or the two or three part-time jobs they carve together to make a living. Women don't have to give up their jobs if their kids get sick because they can't take off to take care of their kids. He wants to start with that big picture view of the workplace. He talks about barriers within business themselves. He looks at three tiers of people who are unemployed, and we'll talk about what those tiers are and how we get people back to work, whether or not this jobs bill is significant. So, that's coming up momentarily. Want to let you know that the second hour of our program today and our hours do kind of go together for those of you who have had to cut back a bit because of the economy, and I think that includes most of us. We're going to speak with a syndicated columnist who's the author of Frugal Living. So the idea of the second hour is to give you ways that you can live more frugally without being cheap about things, but it may lead to a more substantial life if you live a little bit more frugally. Sarah Knoll will be joining us. She has this syndicated column, which is available 5 days a week, and she emphasizes simplicity, family values, and eco-frugality. She talks about cutting down the food bill and finding alternative uses for everyday items. We've asked some people to post things on our Facebook page to come up with ideas of ways to live more frugally, and we'll ask for more of those contributions during the course of this hour so we can learn from each other about frugality. A couple things we want to let you know. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. And we do have a Facebook page if you want to add to suggestions for living frugally or comment on programs. Frances Perkins' show was a big hit yesterday. And if you didn't get a chance to hear it, it's a great book. And it was a wonderful interview with the author from The Washington Post. She's a woman who – somebody ought to do a movie about her, don't you think? That would be good. So the Facebook is just the Kathleen Dunn Show. If you go to Facebook, sign up and become a fan and people are starting to carry on conversations more on Facebook, which I think is A-okay. One more thing I want to tell you about. We are going to rock out on tomorrow's program at 10. We spent a lot of yesterday afternoon, and some of us were saying, so this is work? This is good work. Listening to Motown music, it's a little bit of controversy about whether it's the 50th or 51st anniversary of Motown, but most would say that it started 50 years ago in 1960. Can you believe that? That was 50 years ago? And so we'll be talking with the author of Guitars, Bars, and Motown Superstars and playing a good deal of Motown tomorrow at 10 o'clock. Our guest, Dennis Coffey, made his debut at Motown, forging the unmistakable intro into the Temptations classic, Cloud Nine. And he also played for Marvin Gaye, The Supremes, Stevie Wonder, Gladys Knight, and Junior Walker. So that should be a really fun show. You may want to mark it down that we're going to be doing that tomorrow. So we're on to jobs here in just one moment. And we thought we would start with just an outline. It's a bill, this jobs bill, that's got some components to it. And these are Senator Harry Reid's comments on the jobs bill that he delivered to Congress on February 22nd.
American economy back on track. We have to get the American people back to work. We know that our serious troubles were not created in one day, and we know they'll not be solved overnight. But we have to begin. We have to take that first step. That's what the bill before us represents, a strong first step in the right direction. This is a jobs plan that will cut businesses' taxes as an incentive to hire unemployed workers. It's a plan that includes tax breaks for keeping those workers on the payroll and even more help for small businesses to write off their investments. In fact, Mr. President, this legislation will allow small businesses to write up to $250,000 for equipment and materials that they purchase. That's a good deal. They don't have to depreciate it.
Senator Harry Reid, in comments that he made, that gave an overview of the jobs bill, delivered those to Congress, and indications are, of course, because of the blocking of the filibuster on this, that the jobs bill will pass. Senate is convening now, and it will pass sometime, probably this morning. What do you think about what we need in terms of jobs? We're going to talk about that this hour. Is this a significant step, or do we need a massive jobs program on the order of the New Deal to put people back to work, to take a significant cut at that huge unemployment figure, and it is very, very large in some countries, some states in this country, over 10%, which is pretty rough for people who don't have jobs, to say nothing of the people who are underemployed, and to say nothing of the future of young people who are graduating from school and don't have job possibilities. Our number for you to join this, and we're interested in hearing from those of you this hour who may be unemployed, you may be underemployed, you may have lost a job and have a success story about how you were able to move into the workplace again. If you are a business owner, do you find that these tax breaks and this allowing companies to avoid paying Social Security taxes for the remainder of 2010 on new hires who have been unemployed for 60 days and get that $1,000 tax credit for each job worker who stays on the job for at least a year, is that a way to create tens of thousands of new jobs, or is it too narrow to make a significant dent in the nation's unemployment rate? We're waiting for Don Sykes, and we hope he'll be with us momentarily. So in the meantime, we will just take a few of your phone calls, okay? That's all I have to say. 800-486-8655 is our number, and Kyle from Shorewood is starting us off here today. Hi, Kyle.
Hi.
Hi, go right ahead.
I just wanted to say I've lived in Wisconsin 30 years, and I remember when companies like A.O. Smith on Milwaukee's north side employed, I think it was 10,000 people at living wage jobs. Yes, it was hard work. It was quite physical, but it was manufacturing related, which is really the only sector of the economy that can employ people and pay them a living wage. That's the economist's word, a living wage that allows you to pay a mortgage, allows you to put food on the table, and generally support yourself, if not a few family members, okay?
Yes.
And the manufacturing industry needs to come back to Wisconsin. If it doesn't, then Wisconsin is another California. We'll be bankrupt for the next 20 or 30 years.
And we're sort of in a transition, don't you think, that we haven't really defined what we are? We're not really a manufacturing center anymore.
Not anymore, unfortunately, right. But that's the only way the middle class can make a living. Mm-hmm. You can't make a living driving daycare vans.
Right.
You can't make a living driving school buses 5 hours a day. You can't make a living working part-time cleaning up the Bradley Center. We need an automobile manufacturing / assembly plant in the Menominee River Valley.
Hmm.
That's what we need to put about 4,000 or 5,000 people to work. We have the technology. The people are versed. The people are well educated. We've got card carrying journeyman electricians and millwrights in Wisconsin and Milwaukee working at McDonald's. That's an incredibly shameful waste of what they call human capital.
And what do you think, Kyle, of the plan here that was announced, this $15 billion job creation plan? Is it significant, do you think, or not?
No.
Okay.
No. We need to incent Toyota or Honda or GM if they can ever get their house in order, or Chrysler if they can get their house in order. Or what we really need would be a company that's already healthy, like Honda or Nissan, to come in here and build automobiles, assemble automobiles in the Menominee River Valley.
Okay. Thank you so much, Kyle, for getting us started here today. And we do have Donald Sykes with us now, President and CEO of the Milwaukee Area Workforce Investment Board. Hello, Don. Thanks so much for being with us.
Hi. Good morning to you. It's my pleasure.
Yeah, great pleasure to have you here. You had an interesting interview, I'm sure you've had more since then, but about a year ago, in which you were talking about what it is we need for workers to, first of all, be able to work. And you talked about the importance of health care in this community and elsewhere. Is that still a number one priority for you, that when we look at jobs, we simply have to look at health care?
Well, I don't think it's an issue of simply looking at health care. I think it's a complex economic issue that we're facing. However, if I think of one thing that can have an immediate impact on the most severely disadvantaged people in our community, I think it would be health care. And the reason I say that is because many of the jobs that people have today are low-paying jobs, part-time jobs that increasingly have no health care associated with them. So people end up taking time off, losing jobs whenever they have a health problem. And it's a backwards way of doing things, because it also means that we spend inordinate amounts of money on trivial health issues because people have no access to regular care and end up in an emergency room where a $30 visit to a doctor is transformed into a $400 or $500 visit to the emergency room.
Right.
But it's the kind of sweeping change that can have immediate impact on large numbers of people. And that's why I say it's a major issue.
Right. Before you came on, Kyle was talking about the loss of manufacturing jobs in Milwaukee. One of our listeners talked about A.O. Smith specifically and said that the only way for this city and perhaps other cities to do better economically is to bring back a manufacturing base. Is that what we ought to do?
Well, I think the first thing we need to understand is that the manufacturing base that we knew of in Milwaukee when it was like the Silicon Valley of manufacturing, those days are gone forever. Today's manufacturing is sophisticated, advanced manufacturing, and robots and computers do a lot of the production work.
Mm.
So we don't need as many people to do the work that we need in manufacturing. I did some consulting with one of the automobile manufacturers in Detroit before I went to Washington, and they had a plant that employed 11,000 people. I came back 8-9 years later, and they had torn that plant down and built a new one that only employed 3,000 people,
Ooh.
But it produced more cars.
Ooh.
So the issue really is that our manufacturing is going to be a major part of our local economy, because it is such an important area, but the number of jobs associated with it will never go back to what it was. So we need to start looking at how we're going to transform other job opportunities in areas where people are involved and the jobs don't get exported, because they involve the individuals, such as health, and such as, really, frankly, hospitality and service, The issue in some respects is what we pay people.
Right.
We generally have associated those jobs with low pay, and they are. But I think that the crux of the issue is we need to come to grips with the fact that if a person works full-time, honestly, on a job, whether it's flipping hamburgers at McDonald's or cleaning hotel rooms, they should be able to earn a salary that allows them to rent a market-rate apartment. And until we make that kind of adjustment in our worker pay and supports, we're going to continue to slide backwards.
So how do we do that, Donald? Does that mean a huge increase in the minimum wage? What does it mean?
It means, well, I think the package I'd like to see is that we have universal health care, where people have are covered in their basics. We have the best health science in the whole world, if you can afford it. So I think if we had a basic plan like Medicare is for the elderly, for everybody, people who wanted to have specialized attention and have money for it can do that. I think the same thing is in terms of pay. If I look at the increase in the executive's pay over the last, say, 50 years, and I look at the wages for employees over the last 50 years, you see this huge division. We need to correct that. So when people ask me, where's the money is there. We just need to redistribute it. And I know people don't like to hear that because they want to call it socialist or whatever. Right. They can call it anything they want. I like an economy that works.
Yeah. Well, the figure I was reading last week, which just knocks you out every time you hear it, is the top 400 people who make the most money in this country, their wealth combined is surpassing the bottom 50% combined. Isn't that incredible?
That's the point I'm trying to make, yes. And we get to arguing, and people come up with slogans as opposed to effective ways to have an economy that works for everybody. I believe in private property, and I believe in having a regulated capitalistic system that has social justice as part of our democracy. But we can get to labeling things and forget the realistic basic issues that make a community a wholesome community.
What do you think, John, of this $15 billion job creation measure that will probably pass the Senate this morning? Is it meaningful?
I think anything that can get the Democrats and Republicans to agree, even if it's a small percentage of Republicans, is an improvement over the last couple of months. No, I don't think it's going to transform our economy in major ways, but it might be a first step toward some kind of cooperative working that can put Congress back on track to then make some improvements.
There were calls, as you well know, at the beginning of the Obama administration, and there continued to be calls for massive public works programs in this country to put people back to work, similar to the Civilian Conservation Corps, et cetera. Is that what we need?
I think that we need that in our central cities of this country and in some of the rural areas. Some of the people that we are working with in Milwaukee in our workforce development agency are so far behind in education, have very little or no work experience, have other barriers such as no driver's license, or even if they have driver's license, no access to transportation. But most important, there's a large group of people who, given today's manufacturing needs, as I said, it's more advanced now. Where you used to just go into a plant and imitate what somebody was doing, now you need to understand a computer. You now have to work with a group of people, which means you got to learn and problem solve and coordinate. People need experience doing that, and many of them are in situations where they are not going to be hired by today's employers because they don't have anything to contribute. So we need to have public works to just sort of kickstart our economy the same way that the president kickstarted the economy with the banks. Nobody seems to have objected in a major way to the fact that we decided to protect our economy by backing up the banks. Well, in some respects, we need to do the same thing for our workforce. Not a long-term solution, just a short-term solution with public service jobs. Hopefully that could kickstart our economy, generate the money in the hands of workers so they can support small business.
John Sykes, our guest this hour, president and CEO of the Milwaukee Area Workforce Investment Board. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Our email, talk@WPR.org. We'll be with you in a moment here on the Ideas Network. We're talking jobs this hour and the $15 billion job creation measure that will pass the Senate today. What do you think of it? What do you think on a larger level needs to be done to get people back to work? Don Sykes is our guest. Our first call is John from Milton. Hi, John.
Well, any attempt is not going to work. The critics are saying that true unemployment in this country right now starts at 25%. Yes, I agree. Robots and computerization are going to run entire plants in the future, sans any use of regular help. I think we're going to have to get serious about birth control in this country. We're going to have to think more seriously about family planning.
All right, before we get into the whole big thing about family planning, do you let's start with his jobs part of that. 25% is more like the figure, do you think, Don, of unemployment?
I think that the unemployment, for instance, in some parts of the city, if for certain subsections, may reach as high as 40 or 50%.
Wow.
But yes, I think that 25% is a realistic number when we think and add to that. Many people who may be receiving small payments on SSI or some other benefit, but given the increase in the cost of living, it's insufficient. So they are also looking for employment, even though they may not be listed as unemployed.
We keep hearing this, and I'd like you to fill this out a little bit, that the economy might be showing some signs of improvement, but this high unemployment rate is probably going to stay with us for some time, a year, 2 years, even longer. Is there any way to predict that?
Well, I don't know if there's a way to predict that, but let me tell you what I have a problem with. I think that the way in which we measure our economy is archaic. We are still using measures that are more inclined to the industrial society where we did have all those manufacturing jobs. And part of understanding our economy was how much the employment and wages were and how much we were paying for equipment and what was going into profit sharing to the owners. Today, our measures are built around service economy, and it's a matter of who owns the paper. When we say we have a jobless recovery, that says to me that's a misnomer. We don't have a recovery if it's a jobless recovery. It means that some subsections of our economy are prospering, and those are the things that are leading to the disparity of income because we aren't looking at the whole picture and measuring the whole picture. So, I just think we need some new measures of how do we measure what's a healthy economy, and it's got to include the people. It's got to include jobs. It's got to include the labor market in that picture.
You know, you mentioned that maybe 40-50% in central cities around this country. You don't hear very much about those people at all.
We have sort of taken poor people off the radar.
You got it. I know.
And this is not just minorities in inner cities, which is really a travesty. But I think we have the same kind of problem in some of our quiet locations in rural America as well. When we made the transformation to the new welfare changes in the 1990s, we assumed that by shifting from giving people benefits to giving them opportunities or pushing them into work strategies was going to pay off, as if our economy was going to absorb all those people. It did for a few years, which prevented a crisis. But now as we have moved forward, we're beginning to see the long-term effects of this modernization in our economy. And so we have large numbers of people just falling off the radar screen and are not counted. And we keep focusing on the things that we need to be able to be a competitive economy in the world, which is increasingly competitive, which means we need high-end engineers and technical people. But we must not forget that we have the rest of this population that we have to feed and participate in our economy.
Mark from Boston is next. Hi, Mark.
Hi, how are you doing?
All
I
right.
have a couple comments to say. One, I disagree that we should be thinking about going into a service sector economy. Our problem is we have free trade and not fair trade. I've been driving trucks since 1976, and I've witnessed the transition. In fact, I've hauled the transition from American products to Indian products and now Chinese products. And it really accelerated in the 90s when Clinton gave China the preferred trade status. Now, what we need to do is if these products are being imported to this country, we have to have fair trade, meaning that if you buy a a trinket from China, you know, whatever, a widget, then that widget should be priced at what it would cost to build here. And then we'd have the manufacturing jobs. We'd have people with insurance. We'd have living wages. We'd have everything that we had without crippling ourselves. And that's all we're doing is crippling ourselves. The middle class is evaporating. Now we have the very rich and the poor. I mean, I witness it every day. And I think free trade would turn this around. A fair trade, not free trade.
Done.
I think that I agree with the caller's assessment of what the picture is, but I disagree when he says we can go back to manufacturing. We would have to artificially jack our prices up, or the prices coming into this country, artificially inflate them at such a high rate. The truth is, in China, they have huge populations. They can give them 100% pay raise, and that's a raise from $1 to $2 an hour. And then they want to compete with products that we are costing us $18 to $20 an hour to produce. Now, to jack their prices up to make them comparable to ours would create such an artificial economy that that just won't work. They'll just trade with each other and leave us out of the picture. I think we need to make sure, when I say service economy, we need to make sure the people who work in the service economy get paid wages that rival those we used to have in the manufacturing. It means that then we need to look at who owns the paper. The banks are making phenomenal profits, but they're only going to the hands of a few people. If we were to have a more equitable distribution by giving decent wages for decent work, we could have the kind of life that we're looking for and have people work in the new economies that are coming down the pike, in the green economy and other service areas. With robots and production being done by robots and computers, we can't turn that back. We need to just take advantage of it since we have that kind of technological head start.
Well, Don, how do you get a more equitable distribution of the money without having serious charges? And we've already have heard them. Oh, this is communistic. This is socialist. How do you get those something that's fairer?
We didn't call the communists and socialists when we gave the money to the banks. The first points I was making is we need to stop this labeling nonsense about this is communist or this is socialist. Listen to people say we don't need to have a socialist healthcare system like Canada and France because you have to wait in line. Well, have they tried to get to see a specialist in this country lately? Mm-hmm. They have to wait in line. The truth is we should stop the labeling and start talking about what are the specific issues. The specific issue is, if a person works, should they get a decent wage? What is a decent wage? And do we have, as a country, enough wealth in this country to make sure we can do that? So if we can avoid the labels and shortcuts to really tackling some of these issues, I think we'd be much better off as a society. It is not easy, but I just think that we don't have an honest discussion about these issues in this country. We'd rather label somebody with something as opposed to say, okay, what are the hard facts?
Thanks, Mark, for your call. Roger from Iron River. Hi.
Hello. I guess I'm just kind of a simple person, but working for a living, I'm just wondering how you can keep bleeding the people that are working for a living and asking for more taxes for us to pay, to have to pay out, so you can try to keep people that basically don't want to work in the first place, give them these so-called community jobs. If they really wanted to work, you cannot tell me that there isn't work out there to work. I just look around where I live. If you want to go to work, there's a place to go to work. And you can't tell me in the city, if you definitely want to go to work, that there isn't a place to be employed.
I'm not sure there is right now. If you've got 10% unemployment and more than that, are there jobs and people just aren't deciding that they want to work, Don?
I don't know where this gentleman lives and what his economy is, but it's not related to the reality of the world I live in. We have, at least by conservative estimates, 6 people for every job in Milwaukee. That's under the conservative point of view. Others have said as high as 25 people per job. I can tell you just from the summer employment programs that we operate, we moved from 1,000 to 3,000 kids this past summer. And to show the impact on the families brought the kids in because they were that much concerned about having some kind of income. Mm. This idea that people don't want to work is a joke. We put out a notice for 20 jobs to work in urban forestry with the city, and we had over 400 people apply.
Oh, my gosh.
Well, in the summer jobs for the kids, we hired 3,000, but we had 7,000 who came in to apply. So this notion that people, if they want to work, they can find it, is not true everywhere. It may be in the economy where he is, but it's not the case for many places. And this is good. You know, when I look through the suburbs in Milwaukee right now, and I'm not talking about inner city minority, I'm talking about the southern suburbs where the number of people who are receiving free lunch is an indication of the increase in poverty in those communities. And they're up to 40% at this point.
Mm. And we look at the number of people who are in broadcasting who are coming out of college and the number of applications I've noticed after being here for 17 years for jobs that we have has increased in a huge way. We have lots and lots of people applying for part-time jobs.
The job market is insane right now. And so when the economists tell us that the economy is moving up, but the job situation is going to take 1 or 2 years, I don't know, again, where this gentleman's coming from, but I know that that means there are a large number of people out there who are looking for work frantically and trying to find different and taking part-time jobs and other things well beneath the skill levels that they may have acquired by going to school.
Don Sykes is our guest this hour. He's president and CEO of the Milwaukee Area Workforce Investment Board. He was head of the Social Development Commission here in Milwaukee for a number of years before he assumed a national role in the Clinton administration as director of the Department of Health and Human Services Office of Community Service. 800-486-8655 is our number. Our email is talk@wpr.org. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Here's an email, Don, that's come in from Iron River, from Gary. We need to analyze the difference between Wisconsin and the policies of other states that win competitions for the new auto manufacturing facilities. The voters and politicians need to look in the mirror. I believe a lower tax rate and a more business-friendly culture will result in more manufacturing jobs in the state of Wisconsin.
I think if there's one thing I really want to emphasize is I think we really ought to make sure we have evidence for the things we say and do. And so the question of whether or not Wisconsin has a high tax rate relative to the quality of life in Wisconsin, you can't just equate one measure. So I'm not so sure that the fact that some of these plants go to other communities is a matter that we have such a high tax rate and that some of these communities are prepared to sacrifice huge things to draw in a plant. And in return, they may end up spending taxes to supplement the things that people in that community need because they pulled out some of the benefits that went to those people directly from a healthy mixed economy. I hope I'm making some kind of sense.
Yeah, you're making
but the
sense.
Point I want to make is we need to make sure we have real evidence that says that. I've seen measures that said Wisconsin's tax base is not the worst in terms of other states. And not only that, but that Milwaukee may have a workforce based on our technical colleges and universities that is a higher level that's a big benefit to businesses coming here. We just pulled a company from Spain into Milwaukee in the last month, and the number one reason that company decided to settle into Wisconsin and Milwaukee was they looked at the potential workforce and said, this is what we need. So there's a sacrifice or there's a balance between what's being paid in taxes and the benefits of living in a community that may have a quality of life that the employees prefer.
Mm-hmm. George from Eau Claire. Hi.
Hi. I'm just calling I was listening to that last caller, and I couldn't believe my ears. Yeah, maybe back in the day when unemployment was 3%, you know, maybe some of that, you know, applied. You know, if people could find jobs back then, you know, apply for a convenience store job or you know, a lower-paying job, but not now. You know, those jobs are already taken. And they don't want to hire people who they have maybe just an inkling of thinking that they're not going to stick around for a long period of time. Why would they want to put in the time and effort to train those people? And my second point was, I'm in the construction business, and right now, as you probably know, unemployment is like 26% in the construction industry. It's a big gorilla in the room that nobody wants to talk about. And I'm seeing right now that people are able to get, now commercial projects have picked up. Commercial projects are finally starting to be able to get some financing, but the residential is still really hit hard. And even though this tax credit for first-time home buyers, yeah, that's good and everything, but and the tax incentives, that's also good. But what right now that I'm seeing that people can't get is like for contractors to be able to go to these, you know, homeowners and say, look, I can secure the financing for you to do this remodeling project. You know, the government is providing, you know, $6,000. And, you know, I just see, you know, if the government can, you know, can actually provide direct funding, direct financing, I think that would be an enormous help to pulling the U.S. out of this ditch that we're in.
John.
Yes, I agree with the caller. I think I was just reading something about in the paper that while we've bailed out some of those big banks, we have over 700 to 800 small community banks, the ones that make loans to the people who want to do the things to their homes that will feed the construction industry. Those are close to failing. And if they're close to failing, they're not giving out loans. And so somehow we need to infuse the capacity of those banks to work with people in either some kind of direct incentives or some kind of tax breaks to individuals who do certain things for their home. But we need to somehow kickstart our economy. And the point that the gentleman made about jobs, you know, if people were to look at the average worker in McDonald's and some of the fast food restaurants and look at the fact that they're aging, these are people who have been displaced in regular jobs and have gone into those places and are easily picked up by the owners because they have a work experience and they know they're getting a proven track record, as opposed to what used to be the case where they hired young people and probably had a big turnover because those people were young and inexperienced. So we've got a lot of problems we've got to take care of.
Yeah, thanks, George. Let's go back to the jobs bill for just a moment, Don. The centerpiece, the $13 billion program allowing companies to avoid paying Social Security taxes for the remainder of this year on the people they've hired who have been unemployed for at least 60 days, and employers also receiving a $1,000 tax credit for each new worker who stays on the job for at least a year. What do you think of those ideas?
Well, you know, I'm at a conference right now on prisoner reentry, and we had a couple of businesses here on the panel yesterday about who they hired and why they hired. And we raised the question of this tax incentives. A lot of businesses will not take advantage of these tax incentives because the paperwork for a small business sometimes is extremely complicated, and they don't have the time to want to go through that. And some just don't want to get involved with the government. So we've got some barriers there to get people to take advantage of tax credits. And then, of course, there's some who are arguing that this is a decent approach. It's just too small given the velocity, volume of the problems that we face.
Let's go next to Jean from Elkhorn. Hi, Jean.
Yeah, good morning. I really appreciate Mr. Sykes' perspective on this, and I really agree with the scope that we need to step into. I'd like to see big programs in the city. I was involved in a Habitat for Humanity household putting renewable energy on the rooftops, and it was a great experience, and seeing the potential there for future outcomes is really amazing. I'm calling today for I talk about paperwork with the government. The tax, I was looking at these credits that are for education, and if you could speak to the longevity of these. One's called the American Opportunity Credit, the HOPE Credit, and these were issued for people, students attending schools in the Midwestern disaster area. And I'm wondering if I feel like our job economy is a disaster area. Does he know about those? And one's a lifelong learning credit. And are these could these be enhanced to help us through difficult situations? Again, for your subject about this, Kathleen, I appreciate it.
Mm-hmm. Thanks.
Unfortunately, I'm not knowledgeable about the specifics of the particular projects that she's the program she's talking about. But I can't speak in general to the fact that one of the problems we face in our workforce investment board and trying to get people back to work is that the cost of training, the cost of education and education institutions are such that if you don't have a job, it's hard for you to participate. So things that such as opportunity grants are great, because I just think about the large number of young people I know who, when I say young, many in their 30s and 40s, you know, I'm up there now, and I call 30s and 40s young.
I do too.
come out of school with these huge debts from student loans, and it's really saddled them. So I think things that we can do to create opportunity grants, and I'm saying grants to people, we'll get it back if we can train an effective workforce that's competitive on an international basis by the money they earn and the taxes they'll pay in the future. You know, so it's all connected.
Yeah. Here's an interesting question from Joseph. He has had a hard time finding anybody to answer this. How does a country like Germany, which has high salaries and great social benefits, it was until a few weeks ago the world's leading exporter, surpassed just recently by China?
And the question again is, how did they do it?
How did they do it?
You know, when I look at the European countries, I think that we used to think of having a three-legged stool in our economy. That is, we had government, we had business, and we had labor. In America, we have almost destroyed labor. We don't have a strong representative in our government, in our economy. The voice of labor is not there. I think ever since Ronald Reagan destroyed the air controllers, we have, and I can't say it's all the government's fault or it's all business's fault. I think labor has to own up to some of its own shortcomings. But the fact that we don't have a strong voice representing labor is one of the biggest problems that separates us from Europe. In Europe, when they deal with the economy, that three-legged stool is operative. The same is true in France. The same is true in Holland and in developed countries. In China, you have a whole different measure. You have an economy that's moving from a more top-down dictatorial approach. But it doesn't make any difference what kind of discussion you're going to have. China is going to be the 800-pound gorilla of the future.
Thanks very much for the call. Here's another email. I heartily agree with your guest that workers need higher pay. So where is our revolutionary spirit? We must reduce the salaries of money handlers and the like and transform our pay system. Far too much money goes to too few, especially to those not really making ours a better society, just a greedier society. I guess the broader question is, how do you deal with this issue of greed, Don? I don't quite get it.
Well, I think it's the way we've set the game up, where it was essential to have labor in the equation when you had to have it. But I think that we have not analyzed the impact of robots and computers, and therefore the question comes down to who owns the paper. When I say who owns the paper, who owns those machines? And you don't need labor. And so as a consequence, we now have this economy that because you own the paper and you can go buy the products from China, you can go buy the products from Indonesia, you can go buy the products from other countries that have a lower labor cost, then somehow that's our economy. Well, we have left people out of the equation. We've got to put people back into the equation. And again, I say that means by making sure that we have a distribution system. You know, our people coming out of college into business schools and go to work for companies and get involved in these different stock options and things, all of a sudden is as if they win the lottery and they can own all the money, it ignores the history of the country and all the things that have got us to where we are.
Mm-hmm.
So we need to respect our country and our history and the sacrifices people have made to get us to the wealth that we have and make sure we can begin to do that. I travel a lot into other countries, and I can remember sitting in a restaurant in Buenos Aires, in Argentina, at 2 o'clock in the morning, talking to the busboys. They all have universal health insurance, a month's vacation, and family-friendly policies that allow them to do things to take time with their kids. This is Argentina. Mm-hmm. And if I ask the average American, they would say, oh, they have a backwards economy.
Right.
We need to become educated in the fact that this is a country that needs to make some adjustments on how we distribute the goodies in this country, because we just go to war to protect it.
Yeah. Dave from Marinette, hi.
Hey, how you doing?
All right, how are you?
I missed part of your show, but I agree with your guest on quite a few things, and he kind of hit it on Argentina. I was just listening to him. I think our government in the United States and in state have no clue what the average American works or how much money he makes. I've heard anywhere that the middle class is anywhere up to $125,000 to $250,000, depending on what party you listen to. We have to get our people back into our government back into seeing just what happens with the people. The majority voting tax people don't make over $50,000 a year. And that health care wipes out a third of that or a quarter of that on a lot of people. I just wonder if your guest has any ideas about that. Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
I think that if American corporations were to pay the same percentages of taxes that they paid in 1960, we would have the resources to protect our middle class, which unfortunately, I wanted to say this about the gentleman who called earlier who said our middle class is going disappearing and we're taxing people on. I agree. I think we're just putting the tax emphasis in the wrong place. We need to begin to tax at the other end so that we can protect the people in the middle class. Our economy and our country has thrived and succeeded because we had a very healthy middle class that allowed people who were in lower income areas to aspire to see that health. And it also was the engine that produced the leaders who went on to make larger sums. But if we aren't careful, we're going to lock up the resources of this country in something that reminds me of what feudalistic Europe was, where you have a class of very, very wealthy people who have locked up the money, and everybody else is trying to beg, borrow, and steal to survive.
You spent a number of years in Washington with the Clinton administration, Don. Address his point that people in Washington, and you sometimes wonder what the heck they're thinking when they can't get any kind of bipartisan support for anything. It's driving people crazy. Is there something that goes on in the psyche of people once they start working in Washington that they forget what we're all going through?
It's called inside the beltway, the disease that some people refer to it. But, you know, the truth is we have put so much money into lobbyists. And I almost also fault to some extent the media because, I'm fascinated when I listen to some of the interviews and somebody comes along and says something really that's wrong and they never get challenged on it. You know, and so I have much criticism of the fact that I think our media does a poor job of educating our public on what the real issues are. I'm fascinated with the fact that even CNN, the difference between CNN in this country and CNN in foreign countries, they get more balanced picture of what is taking place. And what has happened in some respects is inside the Beltway, we have people who, of course, when you accumulate large sums of money, you can have more influence. We have reached a point where the greed is. My son wrote a novel, and he talked about avarice is no longer. There's a discussion between the devil and God, and the devil was saying that's no longer a sin. you can have as much as you can accumulate. We've got to get past that and talk about the general welfare in this country, and not talking about welfare of low-income or minorities, but the welfare of the country and the general population. And most important, how do we maintain a healthy middle class?
Right. Well, it's a question we keep needing to answer, that's for sure. I really appreciate your being with us. I've missed talking to you over the years. You're a great guest.
Yes.
And thank you very much for being with us, Don.
Thank you, Kathleen. Mm-hmm. I appreciate it.
Don Sykes, president and CEO of the Milwaukee Area Workforce Investment Board, which is the largest board in Wisconsin, serves the most diverse racial and economic area in the state, in the area with probably the most problems in this area. He has had 30 years of nonprofit, public, and intergovernmental community action, workforce, and social planning experience. He led the Social Development Commission for many years here in Milwaukee before assuming a national role. He was in the Clinton administration as director of the Department of Health and Human Services Office of Community Services. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning and Chrissy Peace for on-air and production of this interesting program. And thanks for all of your calls, everybody. We'll be on this issue again. We just decided to do this today because the Senate is about to pass, and I think it's at the consensus of this show that the consideration of this issue needs to go way beyond a $15 billion job creation measures and ask how do we create a strong middle class and what attention should we pay to the poor among us. News coming up. We'll return.